How's working from home been going for you? Remarkably Remote from GoToMeeting will help you succeed in today's new normal. In just 3 minutes or less, we'll share simple but helpful tips to keep you on track. From managing your motivation, workload, and relationships to hosting and attending virtual events that keep you connected with your clients and colleagues. So check out Remarkably Remote on your favorite podcast platform or head to gotomeeting.com/tips. Welcome to the No Dunks Podcast on the Athletic Network. It's Monday, May 11th, and we're back to break down the latest two episodes of the hit documentary series, The Last Dance. A very happy belated Mother's Day to all you moms out there, and a very happy belated Wedgie Day to everyone. I'm J.E. Skeets, and joining us here on the horn, we got Tass Mellis.
Way to go, Craig. R.I.P. Craig Sager.
We got the bearded one, Trey Kirby.
Heyo!
Heyo! Heyo! The international man of mystery, taking it to the max, Lee Ellis.
Friends.
And last but not least, making the magic happen, it's JD.
Hello.
There he is, and here we are. Last night's two episodes covered a whole lot. We got into the murder of Jordan's father, MJ's first retirement from the NBA, playing minor league baseball, and then his comeback after a year and a half away from the game. So lots to break down. We'll go episode by episode again. We'll start with episode 7. We've been doing that here on our Last Dance recaps. We did start episode 7, you know, with the murder of MJ's father, James Jordan. Was there anything that they shared in this doc, Trey, that you didn't know about that incident or had forgotten?
That's a good question. I had forgotten about the lead up with James Jordan going missing for basically 3 weeks. You know, I remembered seeing that Linda Cohn SportsCenter report. That was my go-to show, no doubt about it, as a child, watching SportsCenter every night and every morning. Same show, doesn't make a difference to me. But yeah, the 3 weeks of James Jordan having gone missing was a stressful time that I completely forgotten about. Because, I mean, everybody remembers the ultimate outcome with James Jordan being murdered. But, you know, it's weird to think about somebody going missing in today's day and age for 3 weeks at a time, you know, despite the fact that they said, you know, we wouldn't hear from him for a couple of days, but he would always be checking in, this sort of thing. Obviously, with cell phones and technology the way they are now, you know, it's kind of tough to be out of contact for 3 weeks. But yeah, that part was something that threw me back, no doubt.
I just think if it was today, I wonder about our show, even me specifically, you know, having done this for so long and being sort of the analyst on our show, I wonder how much we would connect gambling and be those assholes that people were in the media to his father's death. And I would like to think that we wouldn't, but the way everybody sort of analyzes every single thing and the way we need to sort of connect the dots, as Andrea Kramer said in the doc yesterday, there really aren't any dots to connect other than he retired and his father died. I think that even the dots to connect are, it's just, it's so foggy, and I think it's definitely unfair. And I think a bigger part was sort of slipped in at some point where MJ said, I had nothing left to prove. I had already done what Bird and Magic hadn't done in winning a three-peat, and I think that was a big reason why he retired in 98. And so a lot of stuff was unfair. I'm surprised that now how Jordan just lets it roll off his back, that all those people connected gambling to his retirement and potentially to his father's death. I think he's big for that. You know, the Isaiah Thomas thing, hates it. And other stuff you can tell he holds a grudge for, but I'm surprised how he's able to just let this roll, because it would dig at me for decades and decades and decades, and I think it would have been a hell of a lot worse if it were 2020 and that were the situation, because there's so many more shows. There's not just Linda Cohn every night and every morning. There's just, it's endless. So that I think it's kudos to MJ for being able to let it go.
Lee, put yourself back in the early 90s. Did you ever believe in the MJ conspiracy theory that his first retirement was some sort of secret suspension tied to any gambling or stuff like that? Did you at the time believe that?
Not really, no. I mean, he'd been through so much, and, you know, winning the championships, and he'd played so much basketball that he did seem just burnt out with everything, and he needed a break. And, you know, of course, the connection there as well to David Stern, you know, suspending the most marketable star in the world just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Right. I mean, David Stern was such a shrewd businessman. He understood exactly the impact that Michael Jordan had on the NBA and on basketball in general. So for David Stern to say, hey, Michael, stop gambling $50,000 or at a time or whatever, because it's a bad look for us, it just doesn't make any sense at all. So again, if Michael Jordan was seen out on the streets, you know, like trying to sell his watch or a championship ring to trying to get money to go back into a casino, then perhaps there would have been something more to it. But this is a man who earned millions and millions and millions of dollars and basically enjoyed a gamble. So but there's always conspiracy theorists out there. People always try to say that, you know what, it's not this, it's that, and it's something else. But again, I always think about David Stern and how protective he was of the NBA's reputation, and to see the biggest name in the world and say, I want you out of the league, just doesn't compute with the way that David Stern ran and operated business as the commissioner of the NBA.
But this wasn't just conspiracy theories, though. It was in mainstream media. I'd say it was a step above conspiracy theories. There were just assholes that really didn't have anything else to write about. So that was front page news.
Well, yeah, because like you said, Tass, it's human nature. We want to connect the dots. This can't just be a weird coincidence, right? It just can't be that the most famous person in the world's father is suddenly gone missing and was just killed because he, you know, drove a nice car and happened to be sleeping in it on the side of the road, and just two punk teenagers you know, took him out. It's just like, that can't be. So it's got to be something else. Well, he likes to gamble. Okay, he's you know, been linked to shady characters in the past. Okay, this is like a movie. Yeah, it's like, you're right. In today's world, it'd be 10 times what it was even at the time, and you know, it was sounded pretty damn crazy. I think what is strange, though, with whether or not, you know, like, oh, did he sort of step away the first retirement? Like, remove his father's death if you can for a second. It is tough still to grasp with the most competitive person of all time saying three is enough. Okay, that's sort of where that is the one thing I still struggle to wrap my head around, because he can take anything, the tiniest slight, and just turn it into motivation. So why is three enough? I mean, you're right. He says, you know, well, okay, I beat Bird and Isaiah and Magic and whatever. Those were the best of the best, and I'm better. So I'm done. I don't know. Yeah. That part's still a little strange to me. But, you know, maybe because he's so damn competitive, he's like, well, he's so cocky and whatever, and he believes in his ability so much that he's like, well, I'll just go play another sport now. But again, when you tie the father issue, of course, his passing, his death, and like, you know, that idea of like, I don't want to play basketball without my father here to see me play. And, you know, we've had this thing that he steered me into baseball. It makes then more sense with the burnout issue as well, when you package it all together.
Yeah, watching that retirement scene with all those microphones, I was like, man, I remember so much of this. Mark Giangreco, I remember you, the voice of Chicago sports. But then I'm like thinking, oh yeah, this is all the local broadcast that they were seeing. So that was throwing me back big time. But I remember thinking when MJ retired, just the way he was acting up there, you know, he was pretty jovial, really. Like, he was pretty happy to be up there retiring. I remember even thinking back then, he's not going to be retired forever. Because you think as a child, you're like, retiring is what you do when you're old and gray. You don't do it when you're in the peak of your career. But, you know, his dad had just been murdered that season, and that was, to me, the thing that made sense to me, was that Michael Jordan can be sad too. Maybe that's why he doesn't want to be playing basketball right now.
Yeah, and I had totally forgotten that he retired essentially in October. So even though it's unfathomable to think a guy in his prime would retire, and if you just zoom in on that, it's crazy. You have to take into account his father's death, because it happened that summer. Yeah. And so he didn't make the decision until October. And I'd totally forgotten it took him that long. Maybe he would have been a baseball star if he got July, August, and September in to have some have some cracks at the bat, because he would have made the major leagues, as Terry Francona has said. Lots of people have said, if he had some more swings. But he just chilled out, obviously, because his father passed away in July. And yeah, it just that was an avalanche from there, obviously. And it makes sense when you put it all together, but if you take little parts of it, it does sound bonkers.
Yeah, I had you brought up the retirement there, Trey, in early October when he announces it, and you got all the camera reporters there and all that. He basically, MJ within it, says he calls his return, right? Like, he's like, you know, I'm basically coming back is what I took from it. And I didn't remember that at the time, but he's like, yeah, you know, he's like, he almost says as much, like, I'll be back.
Yeah, exactly. And that was something that definitely stuck out to me as a kid was like, he's happy. He says he's going to retire, but he's not old. So he's obviously going to come back. He's still playing for Jerry Reinsdorf. He's just cashing a check with a different logo on it. So to me, it was like, yeah, he's retired for now. We didn't have, you know, like Jay-Z announcing that he was going to retire from rap and then dropping a few albums later. We didn't have comebacks from retirements, but it didn't feel like this is the last time we're going to see Michael Jordan playing basketball.
Yeah, it was less like a retirement ceremony or press conference and more of like, hey guys, I'm just taking a break. I'm really burned out. I lost my father. I'm done with this for a while. I'll be back. But, you know, you can't really spin it that way. It's got to be like the big retirement and I'm done. And then he comes back. I had forgotten, too, that the news broke during game one of the ALCS. After Jordan throws out a first pitch wearing the Canadian tuxedo there, what a look that was.
Ton of jeans.
While playing the Toronto Blue Jays.
I was going to say, Tass, what do you remember from that game? Jays won 7-3, baby. Juan Guzman on the mound. Got the win. Jays 17 hits. Big John Olerud game. Yeah, I was looking it up last night. Juan I'd Guzman, forgotten about that.
Yeah, Juan Guzman definitely one of the forgotten Toronto Blue Jays. He kind of flamed out pretty quick. He had a nice little quick retirement as well, sort of, from the game of baseball. Yeah, they took care of business, did they, those Blue Jays? Yeah, of course they did.
Let's talk about MJ's baseball career, because we get a lot of that in this one. Even though there is a completely different documentary, right? It's a 30 for 30, I think.
Jordan Rides the Bus,
yes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you really want to do a deep dive on MJ playing minor league baseball, but it is... I mean, look, we just got done talking about how crazy it is for a guy who's the greatest athlete in the world in his prime to step away for you know, 17, 18 months. It's just as insane that he went and played baseball and started with a 13-game hit streak and wasn't bad, you know, for not playing baseball in 14 years. And he's only put into AA because, you know, it's the lowest level that they could handle for the media relations and the media firestorm that he was going to bring. Like, that, I didn't know that part. That was pretty wild. And then, yeah, he starts to struggle with the breaking balls and becomes a little more average. But, well, Tass, I mean, I don't know if we're going to throw the Rounders music in here, but what do you think of MJ's baseball swing and his career there?
Well, a lot of things. First, kudos to the White Sox organization for not bringing him up and throwing him in the big leagues and throwing him in the fire. It's kind of hard to think about the best basketball player in the history of this planet and still they don't bring him up. They keep him in the minor leagues for an extended period of time. They let him go play fall ball after the season is done. He goes to Arizona and plays fall ball. So kudos there. I think that's a good move. I totally forgotten that he came back in 1995, right before he returned to basketball. He showed up to spring training and was ready to play ball, had the bat on his shoulder, had the bag in his hand, and was ready to play. But because of the labor situation, he wasn't going to go pick it with the players. He wasn't going to be a replacement player. So he said, I'm done. And I'm not sure in the 30 for 30 if it's documented, but there's players in an Athletic article that document fall ball that say if there wasn't for the strike, he would have came back in 95. And who the heck knows what happens that season if he sticks around and tries to play it out. So listen, big picture, baseball is hard and not everybody can just go out and even the best basketball player in the world and just kick ass. And the body talk is interesting. Lee, what did you think about a basketball player has to remake his body into a baseball? I know it's just he didn't really get at a lot. Tim Grover didn't get at a lot. Why it's so different other than MJ said, there's a lot of chest and shoulders in basketball, and nobody cares about chest and shoulders in baseball.
Yeah, that was I was enjoying that part of it. But also, you know, Michael Jordan moved around the basketball court so smoothly. He looked like that's where he belonged. But in his baseball gear, he looked a little gangly at times, I thought.
Yes,
you know, particularly,
totally.
You know, when he swung those the bat a couple of times and was making it to first base, it took him a little bit longer to sort of get to his top speed. And then out in the outfield a couple of times, it's like, ooh, yeah, he doesn't look like a baseball player out there. He looks mm-hmm. like a guy from another sport who's trying his best to play baseball. You know,
yeah.
I mean, again, I didn't actually know that batting, that hit streak. I thought that was pretty impressive. I don't care sort of what level it is. I mean, to be able to hit that 13 games in a row, I believe it was. I thought that was good. So he was clearly, you know, he wasn't a total dud there at baseball, but at batting. But yeah, just out in the field, it just, you know, it's funny seeing it because baseball, there's not many 6'6" guys, really, is there? Most guys are closer to sort of 6 foot, 6 foot one or whatever.
Well, they definitely don't play outfield if they're 6'6".
Right.
If you're 6'6",
yeah.
It's like comparing to the White Sox. You're Frank Thomas and you're the biggest guy on the field and you're smashing taters. Michael Jordan's out there 6'6", hitting like Walt Weiss.
Yeah.
I think it was... Richie Sexton was a big guy, wasn't he, in baseball? 6'10" or something like that.
Great
he,
call.
Sure.
Well,
Randy Johnson if you wanted. But
well, the reason I didn't choose Randy Johnson is because Richie Sexton was a decent batter and he kind of looked comfortable at the plate there when he used to swing. But Jordan just sort of, you know, the bat looked a little bit off and, you know, his stance was a little bit, you know, sort of wrinkly there, if you know what I mean. And
yeah,
he just
totally.
He
that's
just
what everybody wrinkly. Says. No, he had a very quiet bat. He had a very quiet stance. No movement whatsoever.
Yeah.
I was surprised by that. Elbow down, everything sort of compact, not moving much, and then exploding as the ball got there. And it is said that he had a very long swing at first. He couldn't catch up to balls. But then he shortened it up and became a bit of a poker. There is a clip going around of... former Red Sox coach Terry Francona, who was his manager there with the Scorpions in fall ball, and I guess as with the Birmingham Barons there, and Terry Francona is the third base coach at the time because they're doing a live hit. They're interviewing Terry Francona as MJ goes to the plate, and MJ rips a triple, slides in head first to third base. Great clip, great to see MJ circle the bags. And, you know, I kind of disagree that he didn't get up to full speed. I mean, he beat out a ball there, I think, in an infield hit.
But from the start, though, it's like watching Usain Bolt in the 100 meters. Like,
yeah, he's got to unfold himself out of the box. Yeah, but once he gets going,
he's fine, yeah.
I love seeing that clip of Jordan basically relearning baseball, but he's doing it in a basketball gym. I remember thinking that was the weirdest thing at the time. He's like wearing, you know, I think he's got the Jordan 9s on. It looks like he's playing basketball, but he's fielding grounders and just kind of botching them all over. I couldn't believe, though, that they didn't include the clip of Jordan playing in Wrigley Field. They played a Cubs-Sox exhibition game before there was interleague play. Jordan rips a double down the line. It ties the game, and Harry Carey, the famous Cubs announcer, is going crazy for Michael Jordan just because everybody's so excited that he's playing baseball in Chicago. That was like a major moment for me as a kid, but I was surprised it didn't sneak in there.
Yeah, I think it's been funny to watch the debate going on Twitter since these episodes aired about whether hitting 202 and driving in 50 runs, like, in double-A ball was impressive or not. Like, it's such a hilarious argument to me. Like, some people are like, it's not that good. Like he's not making the majors, man.
It's also very funny that back in the day when Jordan was playing baseball, you're like, come on, man. You saw him on the cover of Sports Illustrated. They're trashing him. He went on to never talk to Sports Illustrated again. But now we're like, hey, 200 in the fall league? That's pretty impressive. As if anybody is an expert on 1990s double-A ball.
Yeah.
Well, reading on The Athletic, all the guys he played fall ball with, all the guys who rode the bus with him, there is a lot of criticism basically saying, like, he didn't have it. He wasn't a natural. But if he did stick around for a couple of years, he could have been a 34-year-old rookie in Major League Baseball.
Okay.
I think he'd still have a 10-year career in the majors at 34, though.
Shout out to Julio Franco.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, because, like, you're seeing, again, last night, the comparisons to the 202, people bringing up that Tim Tebow hit, like, I don't know, off the top of my head, like 270, a little bit better than that. And everyone's like, no one thought that was impressive, like, at all. Like, and this happened the last couple of years. Now the counter is, I think Tim Tebow played a lot more baseball, if I'm correct. Like, Jordan legit just dropped into it after not playing for 14 years. So, like, I'm not saying it was incredible or not. I'm doubtful he would have, like, been a true MLB player, picking it up the sport when he did. I don't know. I'm not sure I believe that. Now, would he have been put on a roster? Like you were saying, Tass, you're almost surprised that he wasn't for a sort of a marketing ploy and all that. Yeah, I'm sure that would have happened. But that's different than actually being a legit MLB player, which I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't think he could have, having, again, not played it basically half of his life, and then having sort of the size that he did. Which was probably a bit of a detriment to him at the plate, for sure.
For sure.
I'd love to compare his statistics to Garth Brooks' time in spring training with the San Diego Padres. Garth has more of a baseball body than MJ does, so maybe it was a bit easier for him.
Well, you got to see this head first slide into third base.
Yeah.
Impressed. You know, that's sliding is not something that comes natural to people who don't
play. Sure.
And especially more so on your butt than sliding head first. Slide head first, you're doing a slip and slide, just go for it. But in this situation, Terry Francona really didn't need to tell him to get down whatsoever. The ball was not anywhere close, but you can hear Terry Francona because he's mic'd up. Get down, get down. MJ, no problem. Laying out like he's Dennis Rodman going for a loose ball and sliding into third base. Now, MJ wasn't very aware of where the ball was because Terry Francona was like, watch ball, watch ball, watch ball. Because it was loose, he could have got up and run home to home plate. Oh. MJ was just ready to call time. And
smoke
just
a cigar.
Yeah, take the dirt out of the belt and just be proud. Just brag his ass off that he just hit a triple, which is not easy to do.
Sure. Find the gap. Use your speed. I will say, watching all the baseball highlights, I started thinking about it a little bit. We always have this debate, or we've been asked about it before on a Beach Steppin' podcast, or even way back in the day, I'm sure. We've probably been asked it a million times of, like, what sporting event do you wish you were at to see, right? You know, and we're, of course, usually picking NBA events. MJ scoring 55 in the Garden, or scoring 63, or Will Chamberlain, whatever we say. It'd be pretty cool to say you were in attendance when Jordan hit his first home run.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It'd be a pretty badass, like, cool little sporting event to be at. Obviously not like a 30,000 seat stadium or anything like that. We're talking a small stadium and, you know, not that many people there. Yeah, you got people peering under the fence. I like that shot that they showed us, but that'd be pretty cool. And I think he only hit, was it three? I think he hit three home runs, and maybe one of those was an inside the park. I could be wrong, but that'd be a pretty cool sporting event to pick. See MJ go yard?
Yeah, it would be awesome. Or, like, it would be great to be the pitcher who'd be like, yeah, I gave up a home run to Michael Jordan. You'd probably feel good about that.
Yeah, that's funny you say that. I was thinking that, too, because he has this 13-game hit streak, and we're told, like, you know, pretty damn good with the fastball. You know, he could catch up to it. He could see it all right. And then they start, like, well, let's just throw him breaking balls. He can't hit these at all. I was like, if I was a pitcher in double A, I'm like, I don't know what's cool. I guess what's cooler, striking out MJ or having him hit like a home run off me? So I was like thinking, like, would I actually just not listen to my coach and just throw him some fastballs to see if he can go yard again? I don't know.
I think Mitch Williams, huh?
Yeah.
I think you'd want to strike him out and then talk trash, you know, send him back to the box, you know. Like,
yeah.
This ain't the basketball court, MJ. Get out of here. You
hey,
know?
Bag it, Michael. Bag it.
Send him back to the dugout, not the box. You know?
Oh, well,
that'd be weird. Hey, go back to the box. I'm in the box. I just struck out.
Stay there.
But see, maybe Michael doesn't know all the vernacular anyway. So he's like, I don't even know what this guy's talking about. You got to play the mind game with him.
Well, that you just reminded me of something I was thinking watching it, Lee. We're told, and I believe it, I mean, like, that MJ was a huge baseball fan, right? Big part of because of his father and their love of the sport. Trey, maybe you can answer this better than anybody else. Was MJ, like, was he a Cubs fan? Was he a White Sox fan? Was he another team's fan? Like, did he ever talk about, like, an allegiance to a team in the MLB? Like, you know, like, because we've seen LeBron show up or whatever, you know, wearing Yankees caps and stuff. Like, I don't ever remember Jordan talking about his love for baseball, I guess, before he played baseball.
I remember in the Come Fly With Me video, he definitely talks about baseball being his first love. So I understood that Jordan going back to play baseball. I think he was just generally associated with the Sox because Jerry Reinsdorf owned both teams. I don't know if he had an affinity for one. I don't remember him, you know, like showing up to games. But then again, the Cubs and Sox were both not great during Jordan's run in the 90s until it was a little bit too late. But I don't anticipate him showing up to support Sammy Sosa, who went from the Sox to the Cubs, you know? But yeah, for me, he will always be a Sox guy just because of the Reinsdorf connection.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just like he said, I don't remember him showing up to World Series games unless he was throwing out the first pitch, I guess, or I guess that was the ALCS. Yeah, I just don't remember him like, that's my team, you know?
Well, yeah, basketball season starting as well, right? Like, that's exactly when the season is ramping up, especially in the 90s.
Yeah, true. Another big part of Episode 7 is we get a lot of Jordan's teammates discussing him, you know, and how hard he was in practice. And we had a lot of great little stories and quotes and great footage, too. We circle back to Scott Burrell being MJ's whipping boy. There's a good chunk of that. We get Judd Bushler saying we were his teammates and we were afraid of him. We get Will Perdue straight up calling him an asshole. I mean, Will Perdue is not holding back how he feels about MJ, I thought, throughout the couple of clips we've seen of him.
None of this hold is back, really... And he's a current Chicago TV personality as well. Just no problem doing it.
He's telling it like it is. So, look, I don't think any of this is surprising, but the footage is definitely like... You know, wow, MJ calling everybody a hoe and getting on everybody out there in practice. What do you think of that, Lily, seeing behind the scenes?
Scott Burrell's becoming quite an interesting character in this whole documentary. You know, he keeps on popping up. And it starts off pretty bad for him because Michael wouldn't give him a hug. But then Michael sort of shows some respect to him, at least in this, these last two episodes, because he's trying to work him. He sort of wants him to become a better player, and he sort of goes hard on him like that. But he also kind of, you know, belittles him at the same time. So it's tough to figure out. But, you know, Scott Burrell, at least, you know, he keeps on, he's a recurring character. He's like Putty maybe in Seinfeld, you know, he just sort of keeps on, he just keeps on popping up there. But again, it's not, you know, this is, I think, what Jordan was referring to before we even saw the first episodes, that people are not going to think he's a nice guy because of the way that he treats his teammates. But we also see why he is like that, because he wants them to be at the top. He talked about, you know, Luke Longley and Steve Kerr sort of acting as though they were champions when they didn't play on those first three championship teams. And so he wants them to be like, hey, you had nothing to do with that. I want you guys to be the best you can be for this team and for the and for the current situation. So, you know, he's just a sort of maniacal, a maniacal, you know, work like workhorse himself. And he wants and expects everyone to be as passionate and as committed to practice and to the game as he is. And his way of sort of showing that comes off that he's a bit of a prick. But again, that is what his reputation was like, even at the time, because, you know, when you're at his level, he expects everybody else to at least strive to be on the same plane as him.
I'm happy to hear you calling him Scott Burrell the entire time, Lee, because it seemed like Michael Jordan, anytime he addressed Scott Burrell, was calling him Scott Burrell. That was pretty funny. But Scott Burrell, he seems like a super chill guy. He's like, whatever, man. I got drafted to play in the MLBs. I was great in college. I'm an NBA champion. And Michael Jordan just yelled at me for an entire year. It was awesome. The guy seems super happy, and that probably just drove MJ crazy. I love the how they opened that scene, and he's just making noises at Scott Burrell. Woo! Woo! Thinking about changing my catchphrase, actually.
Yeah, I think that's the conspiracy theory that I want to start get going, really, is that MJ hated Scott Burrell because Scott Burrell was a better baseball player. That really burned deep inside of MJ. He was just a natural Scott Burrell. I'm surprised they didn't make a bigger deal of Scott Burrell scoring 23 points, right, in Game 3 versus the Nets. I mean, it was slipped in there, but I actually thought these last couple of episodes, all this Scott Burrell hate was leading to, like, this, like, see? MJ made Scott Burrell. He made that come out in Game 3 versus Nets. By the way, completely pointless Game 3 versus Nets. It doesn't really matter that Scott Burrell went for 23 in that, in my opinion, and I think MJ went for way more anyway, but they did it. It actually shocked me that they didn't make it like a a bigger deal that Burrell had his moment and it was all because of MJ. Instead, it was just like, nope, Scott Burrell's a really cool, nice guy. you couldn't really phase him. I love that part.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because MJ sort of softened the blow by saying beforehand, people are going to think I'm an asshole after watching this documentary. But I didn't think he was that much of an asshole. Maybe it's just because his reputation has always preceded him. It's always been there. But watching this stuff, like, yeah, he was on Scott Burrell. But, you know, he didn't slap anybody like he's Charles Oakley slapping Scottie Pippen. There wasn't. He was... I think there was a lot more that did happen behind the scenes that we didn't get we didn't see, but you know that stuff was definitely fun. I love the Steve Kerr stuff. To hear that story of you know, we all know that story, but to hear MJ and Steve Kerr talk about how he gave him first Steve pushed him in the chest, and MJ is not having that, and you know, he did punch him, and they had to be separated, and MJ apologized and said that wasn't him. Or that, you know, that was beneath him, I should say. And Steve Kerr earned his respect. And Steve Kerr, looking at the his games played, he didn't miss a game when he was with the Chicago Bulls. Oh, no, he only played for four of his seasons. So respect to him. I'm sure MJ respected that Steve Kerr showed up every day and got out there for four straight seasons. He was an 82 man. And I don't know. Do you guys think he was a big asshole after watching some of that footage? I didn't think it really.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, but you're right. None of this is surprising, this part. I mean, if anything, we knew Michael Jordan uses everything as motivation, and he wants everyone to play like him. And his leadership quality or his leadership style is to be a tyrant, as he even says. I mean, like, I actually thought, you know, I mean, everybody's talking about it. The super emotional part at the end of episode 7. Where MJ, to me, you know, playing, you know, armchair psychologist here, is a little torn, right? When he's getting worked up about, hey, this is how I did it. I just wanted you to be a winner, and this is how winners do it, and this is how I did it. And you had to come with me and be on my level and be a soldier there with me. But at the same time, struggling a little bit maybe with, God, I was a prick, and some of these guys, my teammates, yeah, they didn't like me. And on one hand, I don't give a damn because I'm MJ, and I'm wired that way. But I'm sure a little bit that can maybe hurt a little bit too. You know what I mean? Like that, yeah, is sure. When I saw the tiniest bit of struggle between his leadership style of being an asshole, and yeah, it worked, but prices were paid.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. No, that's fair. I think you can. You can be armchair psychologist with that analysis. I totally.
It was awesome. I mean, it was a wicked scene where he's like, he calls break, right? He's about to, mm-hmm. He's tearing up, and he's, again, he's getting very emotional about maybe how this is going to be perceived, I guess, and what maybe some of his teammates had been saying and how he went about things, and would he have done it differently? Probably not, but maybe he would have. I don't know. It's like one of those things you look back after it's all said and done, and yeah, we got a bunch of championships, so awesome. Maybe I was a little too hard. Maybe I wasn't. I love that. That was my favorite scene.
Yeah, it's the question. How much more do you value the championships than Will Perdue calling you an asshole for everybody right. Who's watching this, right? And for Jordan, you know, apparently he still cares a little bit that somebody would say he's an asshole, but not as much as he cares that he's got 6 rings on his finger.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. A big other thing from episode 7 was the Bulls' first season without MJ. I thought this was really fun. You know, 93-94. Specifically, and then MJ comes back the next year in March. But how about that very solid play we saw there, Lee?
Yeah.
You must have got excited about that one.
I did. Yeah, I wasn't able to clip that one in real time, but I'm working on it right now. That was good. And it was interesting seeing the Bulls, like, even though they were still defending champs and they were obviously looking to try to win again, they certainly, it came off that they were having fun. And that almost that there was a weight off their shoulders, even though they were missing their best player. But I think, again, because of the way that Jordan sort of drove everybody, they sort of enjoyed not having him around in that respect. You know, they were still competitive. They still thought they could go on and maybe win the championship. But they just seemed to be, there was almost some relief that he wasn't there.
Sure.
You know, and Scottie Pippen, I think, really enjoyed the fact that he could now prove to people that he was better than just Jordan's sidekick. I think that's what he wanted to show and say, hey, listen, I'm a great player and you know, I can lead a team. Of course, there's a very big incident there with Tony Kukoc coming up. But, you know, that was a sort of chance for those players to prove that they were more than just Michael Jordan's teammates, that they were good players and that they were still a team that was very competitive and very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they won 57 games, right, that first year without MJ. Mm-hmm. And Pippen finished third in the MVP voting. And yeah, which is wild then when you, like you said, that game three versus the Knicks, less than 2 seconds to go and Pippen refuses to go in the game. And I could remember this so perfectly. This mm-hmm. is definitely a memory that has stuck with me, this game, watching it, and that the blowback from that. I love that little shot there where Bill Cartwright, who we later learn, of course, has a very tearful speech in the locker room after Kukoc hits the game winner. But there's a shot of Cartwright, like, he looks to be like, he's talking to Pippen, right? Like, he's barking at him, or he's saying, what are you doing? What do you mean you're not going back in? Oh, my God, what a powerful little shot that is. And then it's so incredible. Like, it's such, like, if Kukoc doesn't hit the shot, then it's, like, so different, right? It's like, Pippen is maybe validated a little bit.
Sure.
Like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, give me the damn ball. I'm the MVP leader of this team. But instead, Kukoc hits it. And I love that they showed us, and Kukoc mentioned, you know, Phil, he called this play for me because I had hit like 3 or 4 game winners in the regular season. And we get that quick montage of him hitting big shots. And why not go to me, man? Oh, my God. I loved everything about this little scene of no MJ there and the Bulls trying to be good and trying to prove that they're still an awesome team, but then this weird little Pippen thing. And I can't believe Pippen says that he wouldn't change it.
Yeah.
That was shocked me. You know, he says, I wish it never happened, but if I had a chance to do it over again, I probably wouldn't change it, which is pretty shocking to me.
That was
agreed.
Definitely
and MJ playing armchair quarterback as well, where he was asked and he was watching it and he had to comment and said Scottie Pippen made a mistake, but wouldn't Michael Jordan do something really similar? Like, I don't know if he would sit out, but he would be very pissed off. I know MJ is not Scottie Pippen, but Scottie Pippen getting his first shot at his first game winner, here we are, second round of the playoffs. This is a desperate time here for them. They have to get a shot. I can understand why Scotty would be pissed off. I guess the history of him and the Bulls plays a part in this situation, but I can understand why he was angry.
Yeah, but to not go out there, that's the big thing. Yeah, to be like, I'm pissed. Yes, fair. I mean, I'm sure this has happened hundreds of times in NBA games. What? You're not giving me the ball? What? I'm standing over here. I'm inbounding it. But man, then to not, in a playoff game against your rival Knicks, when there's no MJ and you are our leader, to be like, no. He's like, sure. I mean, he's putting himself above the team, right?
I remember thinking he might not ever play for the Bulls again after that happened because, you know, the contract complaints and stuff had been happening with Pippen. He had the moment where he's throwing a chair on the floor. You know, there was the migraine game. There had been things in Pippen's past up to that point where you knew that, compared to Jordan, he was more of a malcontent for the Bulls. So you're just thinking he sat out at the end of a playoff game and the Bulls still won? Are they just going to completely ditch him from here on out? I mean, you didn't really know the inner dynamics of how much it affected the team and how they would eventually go on to lose to the Knicks in that series. But it just kind of felt like things were coming to an end for sure because, you know, choosing to not sit in the biggest moment of your season or choosing to sit out of the game in the biggest moment of the season, that's more quitting, it feels like, than actually retiring is.
Yep.
JD, what did you think of episode 7 here? Anything new that you learned or anything your biggest takeaway from that episode?
It was all new to me, really. And it was probably my favorite episode just because it starts super emotionally with Jordan's father, and then it ends the ending with Jordan getting emotional. You mentioned it before about was he too hard on the other players and all that, and the whole Pippen thing. I loved Phil saying "fuck him," if he's not coming in, just "fuck him," and Kukoc, like all of that was great. I did have a moment where it was at the press conference where Jordan was retiring, and I can't remember who the reporter was, but he was freaking out, and he was saying, "This is the story of the year. It's 1993, and whether you like it or not, this is the story of the year." And I was like, I don't remember this being the story of the year, really. And then I had to do some research, and it was like, oh yeah, there was the Waco standoff was a big story that year, and World Trade Center got bombed, and Monica Sellers got stabbed, River Phoenix died, Brandon Lee died. But you know, it didn't make any of the top 10 lists of the stories that I okay. researched. But that may be because he didn't actually retire and he came back 18 months later.
Right,
but still. Story of the year was a bit much. If you're in the basketball world, absolutely, sure, yes,
yeah,
100%.
And what did you again specifically that final scene of episode 7 where MJ calls it? You know, like put yourself in the director's shoes. There, are you like, wow, we've got gold here. We finally sort of cracked MJ. It appears where he is getting emotional.
Absolutely. Yeah. At the very least, I'm saying, well, we got the ending of episode 7 right there. That was great, but I have to admit, I was a little confused as to why he was getting so emotional.
Yeah, yeah.
It made me think about what he was saying. I had to go back and go, okay, all right, he's really struggling with this, and it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, before we break down episode 8 of The Last Dance, a quick word from a few of our sponsors.
Imagine Michael Jordan has been yelling at you for 6 straight days. Every time he sees you, he heckles you with your full name. Hey, nice glasses, Lee Ellis. I can eat more bananas than you, Lee Ellis. My jeans are baggier than yours, Lee Ellis. Now imagine you step to the free throw line and you know a miss will disappoint the GOAT. Better make this free throw, Lee Ellis. How do you quiet your mind? How do you beat that Sunday scary? Well, Sunday scaries, of course. Sunday scaries are specially formulated CBD gummies with vitamins D3 and B12 that are super consumable and easy to take on the go. The specially formulated CBD products with vitamins can help in all sorts of ways, helping you keep your composure or concentrate on what matters or quieting your mind when the most competitive person on earth is yelling at you. Last year, Sunday Scaries, CBD gummies, and CBD oil won top accolades from Forbes, Men's Health, Allure, and Best Products. Right now, you can get 25% off your first order with the code NODUNKS at SundayScaries.com. That's 25% off your first order at SundayScaries.com when you enter code NODUNKS, where it asks for a coupon on the checkout page. Find out what product might be best for you. Go to SundayScaries.com and use code NODUNKS.
Nearly 22 million kids in the U.S. rely on free or reduced price meals during the school year, and with schools closed during the COVID-19 outbreak, many children may lose their only source of guaranteed food. As the nation's largest hunger relief organization, Feeding America is committed to serving families and children facing hunger in America wherever they are. You can help make sure children get the meals they need by donating now at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
All right, episode 8 of The Last Dance. You can call this the return episode, though you could also call it, where MJ gets his motivation from episode, because within really these last 2 episodes, we get MJ getting motivation from Sports Illustrated, LaBradford Smith not even saying good game to him, mm-hmm. Steve Kerr's fluffy hair, Horace Grant on the Magic, BJ Armstrong on the Hornets, and UNC guy George Kyle walking by him at a restaurant. That's basically just from this episode alone. How crazy MJ is and wherever he's going to find that slate and use it to his advantage. It's wild. Even ones that are made up, because we start with the Hornets Bulls and it's game 2. It's the BJ Armstrong moment. And within that, we get the flashback to that LaBradford Smith game in 93, I think it was, where he had the game of his life. He scored 37 and he may or may not have said, nice game, Mike. he didn't, I guess. And MJ goes out and scores 36 in the first half of the next game because they have a home and home. But yeah, that's this whole big part of this episode is that, what we know from MJ, because we saw it in his Hall of Fame speech, this just like, I'll use anything to motivate me. I don't care what it is. A bad headline, you complimenting me, you just being a white guy that's being a little physical with me in practice, like anything, you turning your back and leaving to go play for another team because they're paying you money, like anything this guy will use to his advantage. What do you think of this episode, Lee?
Oh yeah, no, it was great because he does just find any little pettiness. I mean, looking through LaBradford Smith's career, He basically played, what, three seasons in the NBA, had one good game against Jordan. And I just wish so bad that it was true, that he did say, nice game, yeah. nice game, Mike, to him. Because that just sort of then, you know, it just emphasizes what Michael Jordan needed sometimes to get himself going. You know, you always hear about players these days talking about the NBA season's a grind and they need to find motivation. Well, Jordan could apparently do that against the guy who was basically a journeyman who didn't last all that long in the NBA. And then the next night, Jordan had to go out and put 36 on him. But also, BJ Armstrong was very interesting here because I'd actually forgotten about that series and that BJ was on the Hornets. Yeah. But BJ was such a nice guy. You know, he seemed to me the sort of player who would play his role and understand how Jordan worked. I mean, he talked about how he read about geniuses in a I think it was in another documentary about Michael Jordan to try to learn how he operated and how his mind worked. So when they lose that first game to the Bulls and then the second game, BJ's like, I think I know how to beat these guys, and he goes out and does it. For him to then be sort of celebrating in Michael's face, he must have known that was the sort of thing that Jordan would have just been eating away at him. And then you see the result. Jordan goes out and wins the next three games. So I thought it was great, but it was just also like BJ Armstrong, sort of like, you know, he was messing with Jordan as well, you know, but hit the big shots. And it was a great little moment because that, to me, even though that's not the sort of behind the scenes footage, that's also bringing you back to what was happening at the time and where Jordan was and you know, how he was getting through the playoffs and how the Bulls were getting back to winning. So I really enjoyed it. I mean, you know, we'll move on, but I also love the George Karl one because, like, how do we even know George Karl just sort of walked past and, like, maybe George Karl was just like, you know, I'm my way out. I don't want to talk. I've got a game to plan for. I don't want to stop and chit chat. Because I could also see Jordan seeing that as some sort of reverse psychology.
For sure. Like,
he would just
how dare you interrupt
around.
My dinner?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We're going against each other in the finals. How dare you talk to me? And yeah, exactly. He'll find the motivation whatever side he wants to.
My mozzarella sticks haven't even got here and you're stopping to talk to me?
Yeah, and Jordan says, you know, we've got the UNC connection there with Dean Smith. I mean, maybe George Karl, if he'd said to him, hey, have you spoken to Dean lately? Yeah, no, I spoke to him. He's not too bad. We'll see him. Oh, so you're trying to use Dean Smith against me, eh? Okay, then.
Yeah, it's wild. Kendall Gill was in that Hornets series, right?
Yeah.
I think Kendall Gill was on
the Nets.
Yeah, because he gets dunked on and he told us he's still mad at Kerry Kittles for overplaying on that play.
That's right. Sorry, yeah, I was getting those confused because we did see that Nets series in episode 7, I guess. Yeah, BJ Armstrong, too. Still looks like he's 10 years old.
Yeah.
That guy looks so youthful to me. His face has not changed the entire time he's been on this planet. It's what Nora was like. How old is that guy? I was like, I don't know. I think he's like in his, what is he, in his 50s?
He must be.
He's got to be something like that.
Yeah.
Just like he looks like he's 16. I was like, I know. He's got one of those youthful looks.
I thought it was even strange to remember him having a buzz cut, because to me, he would always have the little short flat top and a plain face. He also grew a beard at one point. I remember BJ Armstrong, you know, basically because everybody's saying, this guy looks so young. He tried growing a beard and you're like, I don't think so, BJ.
Yeah, he's 52.
Okay, wow.
He looks great.
Yep.
And what a great scene that was. You know, he hits the shot, he is celebrating, and then we get Jordan in the locker room smoking a cigar, just like taking little shortcuts of a bat, acting like, I don't know, like a cartoon mob boss or something. It was like teetering for me on very cool and very weird the entire time. Not even pretty cool, pretty weird. This was extreme. It's like one second he's giving these amazing insights onto talking trash, but also you can barely understand him because he's got a giant cigar in his mouth and he's taking these little sissy cuts with a bat. Very weird to me.
Yeah, it would... I only wish he was wearing like a golf glove in that scene because it like wraps up Michael Jordan in one shot, right? He's got the baseball bat, he's dressed in basketball gear, he's got his Jordan's kick, up there on the wall, and he's got a cigar. I mean, if you were just missing like the golf glove to me, and then it'd be absolutely perfect in summarizing Michael Jordan. But yeah, that was a weird little moment.
And it looked like he had a painting of Michael Jordan in the locker next to himself. Yeah. Michael Jordan. It looked like as soon as the camera cut away, he's going to be saying, shuck away, boy.
So we get MJ's return. in March of 95. Tess, do you remember this moment? Do you remember the I'm back facts? Do you remember the Bulls being sort of 500-ish and MJ coming back wearing number 45?
We didn't get fax machines in Canada until the year 2007, I think. So, no. I remember him coming back. I remember those are the facts. I remember him coming back, yeah, to a mediocre team. And I blocked it out of my mind like I block out Wizards Jordan from my mind. I never think of the mediocre Jordan. The guy who just couldn't get his teams over the top. And so to see Horace Grant and to see guys taking it to him on the other side and to see the strip from Nick Anderson was felt new to me. Like I had it in my memory banks, but I think I cut it out because I didn't want to remember it.
Oh, yeah. I remember hating seeing Nick Anderson get the best of Michael Jordan in the 95 East semis as a kid, like being 15, 16, whatever the hell I was. Like, that just was like, what? That's not right. That's wrong. And he's wearing Jordans too? That's even worse. Nick Anderson was. But yeah, I didn't remember that he was wearing his shorts backwards when MJ came back. I did not know that.
No. They didn't tell the story right, man. Oh. The shorts looked backwards. That was a botch by whoever the equipment manager was. They put the logo on the wrong side. At least that was the story at the time.
Okay, so the shorts were on correctly, but the logo looked like they were on backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Because that makes more sense because, you know, what we're told and what we've even seen and we talked about in the last couple of episodes, like how meticulous MJ was, like lacing his own shoes and everything, right? Like he seemed to like have a, you know, go step by step in getting ready for a game. So it would be a little weird. I know he's been gone for a little while, but to then just put on his shorts backwards seems a little.
And we got another shot of him lacing his Jordan 11s from the bottom up. This guy does not F around. I am so shocked to see a man of his stature lace a shoe from the bottom. It's just he's doing it all the time.
It's just the way that he likes it, though. You know, sometimes if someone else just laces them and they say, "Here you go, they're done," he's like, "No. I like them done my way." You know, I'm the same. Yeah, I know you used to work in a shoe shop there, Tassie, and you know, when someone brings out the shoe, I do like to sort of go from the bottom up and get it all nice and tight around my foot. So I'm just saying that's one thing Michael and I have in common.
So you would, I actually feel like Michael Jordan too, watching this episode. His first love was baseball, and now he loves basketball a lot. Same season. Yeah. But so let's say a shoe comes out to you.
Yeah.
And you're trying on you got a big footwear. You got 11 and a half there.
Yeah. Nah, bigger than that. I'm
12 and a half. 12 and a half. Sorry. I'm mixing up feet. I'm mixing up our sizing chart here on the no dunks. Yeah. So you get a fully laced Jordan. You say, "No, thank you." I'm going to pull it out and lace it from the bottom up.
Well, I don't pull it out, but I certainly I like to tighten it from the bottom up.
Right.
So before Well,
you're readjusting basically. Yes, you're not pulling the whole thing out, but you're going right to the bottom.
Yeah. If I'm spending $150 on Jordans, I'm like, "All right, I'm not trying them on until I've laced them, you know, and they're tied around my foot." So I've got a wide foot as well as a long foot. So that's where it's that's where it's unique.
Humble brag.
Yeah. This guy needs a lot of Roman.
I'm a manscaped man myself. Tiny feet. I got to do everything I can.
That's what I was thinking, Trey. You and I should go. You and I should go shoe shopping just to mess with the shoe salesman. Like, I've got a big long wide foot. I got a small skinny one. Like, all right, guys, come on.
Okay. Well, we got onto that. But it's, Tess, you said that you try and like almost keep it out of your memory that MJ lost. I mean, they lose to the Magic as we see in this episode, episode 8. What's funny though is I forget that he actually was kicking ass when he came back in the regular season for a guy that hadn't played competitive NBA basketball for, again, 17, 18 months. Because he has the game winner versus the Hawks, and then a few days after that, I think in his fifth game in his comeback, he scores 55, the double nickel game in MSG. Like, God damn it. Like, I don't know. That's almost more impressive in a weird way than the whole baseball 200 thing. Like, the guy just plop him back in, and then he's going for 55. Like, yeah, against a good team, it's amazing.
I haven't gone through it, but I'd like to see his averages and his scores in Madison Square Garden. It seems like he never had a bad game, never had an off game. You know, that was his place where he knew he would go and sort of get his groove back. Because I remember when he first came back, and I thought, there's no way he's going to be able to come back and just dominate so quickly in the NBA. And those first couple of games, you know, he wasn't shooting the ball all that well. He did have the game winner. But then when he had the 55, he thought, oh my God, he's just going to come back and win the championship. So for them then to lose to the Magic was surprising. But I like the Horace Grant moment we had there after Nick Anderson was talking trash to him after game one, saying 45 ain't 23. And Horace Grant's just like, you idiot, what are you doing? And then and then I actually forgot that he changed mid-series.
Yeah,
from 45. I thought he just finished out that season at 45.
So did I.
And started the next one at 23. But yeah, he did it, got fined $100,000 apparently for doing it. But that's nothing to him. The team probably paid it anyway. But then when he comes back, has that incredible game in game two. And that's again where you sort of feel this is the old Michael Jordan, where he's not going to lose. So it was a surprise to see them go on and lose that series in the end.
Yeah. It would
be an easy article to write for writers if they won the championship. Like, this guy is the best basketball player in the world. He came back and he won. I wonder if guys like James Harden, for instance, are seeing, you got to train, man. You got to be tip-top shape every day of every year to be ready to play and to have the longevity. Like, part of it is being able to play 82 games and playing in the playoffs. Like, he ran out of gas, and he just wasn't ready to be Jordan. It's still, like you said, Lee, it is kind of odd to think that a guy can just come in and take over, but it's Jordan. You'd think he would be able to, but that's just the way it is. And he didn't get to work out with Tim Grover and build that basketball bod. And also watching Tim Grover makes me think, would I want to work out with Tim Grover? Like, part of me is like, yes, that guy would motivate the ish out of me. But also, like, I don't know. I don't know if I'd like it. I'm leaning towards yes, though. I'm leaning towards Tim Grover would get me groving.
I will say one thing I didn't like about episode 8, and I get it, this is a Bulls documentary, this is an MJ documentary, but the glossing over of some of the teams in this episode, like the 95 Magic, we were like led to believe it was like Horace Grant was the man on that team. Like, Horace Grant was good, really good, but we got like a little throwaway Shaq line and Penny line. You know, it was like more like the Horace Grant, Nick Anderson show, which I thought was funny. And then again, later on, the 96 finals versus the Sonics, it was like, it was just Gary Payton. And there was like one reference to Sean Kemp, and it was that he was Gary Payton's alley-oop partner. Kemp was incredible during that season and in the 96 finals. I don't know. That's one little thing, but of course it's not about really those other teams. But yeah, it was Trey... fascinated as a young kid at that time, was it heartbreaking to you to see, oh my God, Jordan is sort of human? They lost to the Orlando Magic?
100%. Like, shocking to see Michael Jordan lose, shocking to see him shoot an air ball in a clutch situation, because, like you're saying, that game winner against the Hawks and the double nickel against the Knicks, with Bill Wennington saying, me and Michael went out there and combined for 57 points in the win because he gets that last dunk.
Yeah.
You thought they were going to win the championship. You know, Jordan debuts the Jordan 11 in this series as well. You never see Michael Jordan wearing white shoes in the playoffs, but he's wearing them against the Magic. He switches back to 23, goes for 38. You're like, the Bulls are back. They're 100% back. But then, you know, they botch it. They basically botch it. They just don't have the right kind of players to hang with this Magic team. And, you know, I was listening to a Simmons podcast not too long ago, and he's arguing that it doesn't matter what level of Michael Jordan they have, they're still losing. It just, to me, felt crazy to see Jordan lose in the playoffs because, I mean, even now you think once Jordan started winning, he never lost again. Yeah. And that's what it felt like for sure as a kid, but it happened.
Yeah. No, I remember being shocked as a kid too, and I wasn't even a Bulls fan like you. I'm more of an NBA fan, and you just think he's Superman. It's weird to see Superman lose. You're just like, what? How? I didn't know that was possible, but it was, of course. And the Magic were a great team. They're obviously a young team, and Horace Grant. I don't want to say like Horace Grant was not good. He was instrumental in that win. Same with Nick Anderson. But come on, it's like Shaq. It was Shaq is like, you know, how many years later is already on the top 50 players of all time. what was that, 97? That's basically announced. The guy's played like 4 years at that point. It's, I mean, he's that damn good. We also get the filming of Space Jam after the loss, like into that sort of summer. And we get a little bit of footage. I could have used a lot more. Maybe it doesn't exist, of these secret games, whatever you want to call them, these games, practice games on the Warner Brothers lot, where you got guys like Reggie out there and a bunch of other stars playing. A couple guys I didn't even know who the hell they were that you would see in these little clips. But that was pretty cool to see the Space Jam, because we had heard the story. They build him the dome and all that so he can continue to work out and get ready for the NBA season when he comes back the next year. But that was cool. I'd love to see a lot more of that footage.
Yeah, and the schedule that he was on there was crazy. Reggie Miller talked about it. You know, his call time was 6 or 7 in the morning. He would shoot all day, and then they would have games sometimes starting at 9 o'clock that would go for hours, and he would do weights and stuff afterwards. Like, he is a vampire. He's a machine. Like, how, you know, especially when he's also trying to get back into NBA game shape, you would think obviously that would be where his heavy focus was, but he had this movie and he shot it and did it. But it's crazy now to think. I mean, imagine like LeBron James was doing that. I think we would look at that now and think, like, he's going to exhaust himself. He's not going to be ready. You know, he's going to run out of energy come playoff time. But it wasn't the case with Jordan. But yeah, those sort of pickups. I mean, Reggie said they were some of the best games, and I would love to have been able to watch them. But a bit like that Dream Team pickup game in Monaco, you know, where you're sort of calling your own fouls and, you know, some of the best players. But also how Jordan kind of was sneaky about what his intentions and motivations were, that he was actually sort of scouting some of the best players in the NBA and seeing what they do and seeing how to, you know, probably defend them and go against them when the season came around. So, you know, classic, just really great insight into how Jordan worked and how he operated and how he tried to get intel on his opponents so he would be up to speed come next season.
I just wonder how many times Sean Bradley got dunked on during this, because, like, Sean Bradley was there filming Space Jam, right? Yeah. So, you know, he was around and you know he was a target when they played in the NBA. So is there just, you know, like an hour long supercut of this guy getting slammed on?
Was Barkley in any of those clips? Could anybody find him? Because he's obviously part of the movie as well. I didn't see him in those clips.
No, I don't remember seeing him.
Because Ewing's there and Bradley's there and I assume Larry Johnson's there and maybe Muggsy, I don't know. I didn't see Chuck there playing in those little pickup games. You brought up the comparison to LeBron, the what if with LeBron. I mean, isn't that what happened, Lee? Wasn't he recording Space Jam 2 and then coming into this season? Obviously looking pretty dominant.
Yeah.
Unless I have my timeline wrong. I think that's exactly sort of what was
happening. When is Space Jam 2 coming out? Like, is that...
When did they say? When's it?
2021.
Yeah, 2021. Yeah. Oh. But I think I think they shot it, though. He shot his parts. No, maybe I'm wrong.
I think so. Yeah, I think part of MJ getting back into basketball shape was really, really important for the Bulls, and just like running the show for the locker room to be great again. Like, they came back and destroyed the Orlando Magic the next year with the same roster. Didn't really matter who was playing center. Luke Longley still out there being Australian, still not getting any time in this documentary whatsoever.
Well, they had a Rodman.
They had a Rodman. Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Luke at least got his name said by Michael Jordan, so he just said Kerr and Luke and those guys. So, you know, it's a small victory for sure. I'll take it, though.
I definitely thought it was interesting to hear Jordan and Tim Grover talking about the difference between a basketball body and a baseball body. And the basketball body, you're supposed to have huge shoulders, apparently, because I do remember when Jordan came back for that 95-96 season, he looked different. You're like, he looks like a huge guy right now. Like, he looks like he's going to be dishing out even more punishment than he had been in the past. And, you know, Jordan's game certainly changed for the latter part of his career in the second three-peat championships, where he's shooting all these fadeaways and just kind of bumping guys down in the post. And obviously that played a huge role in it.
Yeah. Tass, you said we get the incident. You said it earlier, sorry. That incident was Steve Kerr. And I like that you threw it in there. Like, we learn, and I think this was maybe, you know, common knowledge, that Kerr does hit Jordan in the chest with a forearm and elbow. Like, he hits him sort of first, and then Jordan punches him in the damn face, and then Phil Jackson's got to say, get the hell out of here. But, JD, this is a little, to me, like our sports version of Han shot first, right? You know, what really went down in that canteen? Does it matter? Is that a pretty important element that Kerr maybe did shoot first in a weird way?
Well, yeah, I mean, Han absolutely shot first. First of all, let's get that out of the way. Okay. Yeah, I mean, this was the first time I heard this story. I mean, I know you guys know about it, and I just assumed that that is how it unfolded. That Kerr, I mean, they say he punched him in the chest, but, you know, I've seen that lots of times in basketball where you basically, a punch could be more of a shove, right?
Shove, and then, yeah. Forearm.
Yeah. And then what did Jordan come back with? Like a haymaker to his eye kind of thing?
I guess so.
If only that was on tape.
Yeah, that's right. So we get the 72-10 Bulls. I was a little pissed, Tass. I don't know about you. Not one single mention of the expansion Toronto Raptors beating the Bulls in the Sky Dome. Huh? What up with that? This documentary is a sham. Couldn't believe it. But I love we get the it don't mean a thing without a ring. After the dominant season, but they want to take care of business and go to the finals. And we get the 96 finals versus the Sonics, as we talked about. And we get the whole George Karl snubbing them at the restaurant. Okay, episode 7, probably the best part. We sort of agreed that very emotional ending that where Jordan has to call it because he's getting all worked up about being super competitive and maybe the backlash to it and all that. Highlight of episode 8, got to be Gary Payton talking about tiring Michael Jordan out and MJ watching GP say this on the iPad. Lee, did you love that one? That scene?
Yeah, because, I mean, he was Defensive Player of the Year, Gary Payton, and we know he's a talker, and the series did sort of turn when he defended him. So I thought what Gary Payton was saying had some sort of validity to it, but Jordan just kind of laughed him right in his face and just said, I had no problem with him at all, as if that wasn't what changed the series. But to be honest, I think Gary Payton has a point there. I mean, that, you know, they switched him. George Karl, I think Gary Payton saying, you know, put me on Jordan or I'm taking Jordan. And he goes out there and they win the next two games. I mean, ultimately, it didn't matter. The Bulls won the championship. But Jordan just sort of laughing, you know, like in that sort of belittling way, I thought was a little bit odd because Gary Payton is a Hall of Famer. He's a legendary defender. I mean, he's a fantastic player. And I would have thought Jordan would have respected it a little bit more because, you know, Gary Payton was a competitor as well. And he went out there and, you know, he took on that challenge and had some success with it. So, but I guess that's just Jordan, like, I guess.
I think,
you know,
that was Jordan's way of respecting Gary Payton in an odd, you know what I mean? Like the like just laughing at like this guy, man, like that guy talks more crap than I do. Sort of how I took it. And also he is going like, because Gary Payton is trying to tell us if George Karl puts me on Michael Jordan in game one of the series that we win the NBA finals. Now, who knows?
Yeah.
I'm still skeptical, and I think MJ's very skeptical that that's how it would go, but that's what GP's trying to tell us.
Well, and look, I agree in that sense that I think the Bulls win the championship no matter what, but it would be interesting to see if something like that happened. Would it go to 7 games? Would it be a bit of a tighter series? Who knows? But, I mean, when the Bulls are 3-0 up as well, it's not that out of reach to think they took their foot off the gas little bit, thinking like we're going to wrap this up in 4 or 5, because that was, of course, the 2-3-2 format they had back then. But, you know, it was a little bit odd to me that Jordan just completely dismissed any impact that Gary Payton had on him or that series when they won those two games. That's what I took from it.
Gary Payton came in injured, had a calf injury coming into the playoffs. First 3 games, he was guarded by Ron Harper, the Bulls' third best perimeter defender, and he went for 15 points on 40% shooting. He was out there trying to be an offensive guy. So Gary Payton coming in here saying that his defense is going to change the series, I mean, maybe it would help because you watch the highlights and Jordan is just torching Detlef Schrempf, Hersey Hawkins, David Wingate, Vincent Askew. Like the craziest guys you would think to even try on Michael Jordan. Maybe Gary Payton helps a little bit, but George Karl said, you're out there for your offense, and he couldn't score against Ron Harper.
Yeah, and I've heard Nate McMillan say, because I think he was injured in the 96 finals, right? Didn't he say, if I'm there, then it's a hell of a different series? Because, then he's obviously a much better defensive player than a lot of those guys Trey just ran through. He's going to help out, no doubt. I still think the Bulls win, but yeah, that's a... Pretty. I love that scene where Jordan just, anytime Jordan's looking at an iPad, has been gold in this series, right? Yeah. I mean, he's just reacting. Yeah. It was brilliant.
Just great to see some incredible names. Yeah, Nate McMillan came back at the end of that series because he was hurt. It was great to see him on the floor. He was coming off the bench, I guess, because he was injured. Mm-hmm. Seeing Frank Burkowski getting the start. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Wow, what a name. We need these names back in our lives, not just when Lee is opening a pack of cards on Thursday.
And as everybody knows or probably remembers, Jordan decided to throw games 4 and 5 so he could win the NBA championship on Father's Day, which fell, was game 6. And we get the iconic scene of Jordan celebrating in the locker room, sort of crying while he's holding the ball. And this is for Daddy and stuff like that. Yeah, he's wired so differently that I wouldn't put it past him if he was thinking that. But that's episode 8. Any random observations, guys, from either of last night's 2 episodes that you wanted to slip in?
I still remember for that title, 1996, just wondering, Randy Brown, what are you doing, man? Why are you trying to take this ball away from Michael Jordan as they're laying there celebrating? He's like lying on the ball, and like Randy Brown is like basically wrestling him, trying to get it back. But I don't know. Apparently, they're really close, those two guys. So maybe that's their celebration.
I thought a good moment. I think it was Judd Butchler was saying, when Jordan came back for the 95-96 season and they were looking at the schedule and he's like, man, we're not going to lose for like 3 months, I thought that was pretty cool because, they had lost the season before, they went out to the Magic. So it's like, would maybe Jordan be able to come back and be to that super high level with a season of off season of training? But I guess he was. So it was pretty cool, seeing those guys say that.
You mentioned BJ Armstrong's haircut, Trey. I like right at the end of this episode 8, and we're going to get a lot more of it, I'm sure, because we're getting close to where we're probably going to get, well, I guess there's only 2 episodes left. We're going to get the Pacers versus Bulls series in 98. Bald Chris Mullin sighting.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That always throws me for a bit of a scare there. I'm like, whoa. I always forget that guy was bald for a little bit.
There's a lot of weird heads in the 97-98 Pacers with their shaves. It looks crazy. You got Rick Smits, who actually, he kind of pulls off the bald head a little bit better than the mullet back in the day. Mark Jackson with a bald head looks super old as well. I don't know how they thought they were going to scare the Bulls with bald heads, but I'm glad they tried it.
Lee, I saw you tweet maybe the sign of the last 2 episodes, legalize Kemp. That was a great one.
Great one. A lot of the Seattle heads like that one too. They appreciate it.
One thing I noticed, the old creepy looking Bulls mascot.
Da Bull.
Oh my God, that thing is no Benny the Bull there. That thing was so creepy looking with more of that sort of plasticky head, right, Trey?
Oh man, yeah, he had like a molded face, and to me that face was like one of the scariest things of all time. I had nightmares of, in the movie The Mask, the villain puts on the mask, and that's exactly what this mascot's face looked like to me. But I actually wrote something up for The Athletic about it. Hopefully it'll be dropping in not too long.
Okay, great. Nice little tease there. And Tassie said it right off the top of the show. Way to go, Craig, has got to be the new Not Great Bob, or in my world, it's the new Shut Up, Dean, because way to go, Craig. That's how this whole episode started, episode 7 started with Jerry Krause, because Craig Sager asked the whole backstabbing question. Krause just storms out and you hear somebody say, way to go, Craig. It's so funny.
Honestly, a pretty decent burn from Krause as well. He's like, because they're winners, unlike that question you just asked.
Yeah.
Oh!
Yeah, he was fired up. Krause was not happy with that. Any other random observations, guys? JD?
I've really enjoyed the structure of the show, like the flashbacks, going back and then back to the present season, the quote-unquote present season. But now that the past is catching up with the present, I am getting a little confused because... Sure. Rodman is back. New guy Rodman is here. I'm like, didn't we meet him 4 episodes ago and all that? But so that's sort of a flaw in the construction, how the past is meeting the present. But I'm fine with it totally. But I, as a casual fan, I did get a little confused there. I also want a quick fact check on Reggie Miller. Lee, you mentioned it earlier. He compared Jordan to a vampire. Vampires sleep all day, okay? They stay up all night and they sleep all day. So that is just a terrible comparison. Yeah. Call him the Terminator or a machine or something. Something that never sleeps, but vampire, no.
Yeah, I don't think a vampire would do well out on the golf course for 18 holes either in the blaring sun. But okay, that's a great point. Task anything?
And the vampire just got voted off the island on Survivor, right?
So. Oh, yeah.
See ya, Nikki. Beginning of episode 7, actually, I didn't mention, Michael Jordan said he was suspended 3 times in the 9th grade before his dad straightened him out and he never got into trouble again. 3 times in 1 year. And that's a lot.
He never says what for, either.
Say that again?
He didn't say what for.
Oh, that's what I need. That's what I need. Give us a little juice. 3 times. You're hitting the three balls there. That's no joke. Yeah, I would have loved to hear about that.
Yeah, and then I love that James Jordan's threat to get him back in line is, well, you're not playing sports unless you go to school. He's like, okay, done.
Yeah.
I've seen my buddy Grish do that with his young son, Andreas, many a times.
Your kid's currency.
Yep. You're not playing baseball tomorrow. No, you're not shooting the basketball tomorrow. And then, wow. Yeah, he'll stop whining or he'll do whatever he needs to do, put the toys away very, very quickly. That's right, JD. You got another currency. Well said.
One more quick point about more information. As a casual fan, we at the episode 7, we saw a lot or we heard a lot from Jordan as to why he wanted to retire, why he wanted to step away from the game and all that. But when he comes back from baseball, like, I understand that there's a strike happening and I understand that he missed basketball, I'm assuming, but we never actually hear from Jordan himself say, I needed to get back into the game, or I was sucking hard at basketball or at baseball. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. He never actually says why he wanted to leave baseball and go back to basketball. Although, yes, it's very obvious, but I would have liked to hear him talk about that a little more in the documentary.
Yeah, right. Or even the sense, like, if baseball was therapeutic to him after the losing his father, like, that he had come to terms with the loss, right? And was ready to go back. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, he kind of reminded me of Kramer going to Mickey Mantle baseball camp. You know what I mean? Like, it was such a huge diversion and something totally outside of his comfort zone. And it was like going to camp, right? Like, it was a vacation for him. And I get that, but I kind of wanted him to hear him talk about that a little bit more, about leaving baseball, going back to basketball.
Yeah. Well, I guess the conspiracy theorists will say that the suspension was over, JD.
Yeah, exactly.
That he was welcome to come back. I think maybe Simmons has talked about it, and they don't bring it up in the show at all, that Jordan saw the landscape of the league at that time and saw, like, an opening to the possibility of, like, winning a couple more championships.
Right.
I have no idea if that's true at all, but, like, just looking at where the league was and, like, maybe if it was diluted a little bit or there wasn't sort of this powerhouse-looking sort of team that he felt like he could sort of get back in there and win a couple of more chips. I mean, I feel like he would think that way anyway, right? Why would Jordan be scared of any team having already had success in the NBA? But maybe there's something to that, too. But you're right. They didn't include that, at least. So we only have 2 episodes left. That's it. And you're right, JD, the timelines are converging here because we're getting the one in the past with the one of the, I mean, I say present, but of the season that we're chronicling are getting very, very close. And I'm sure they're going to sort of merge into one, right? For episode 10, I would assume.
Yep.
Is what's going to happen. But let's hear what you guys thought of the last 2 episodes. We just broke them down. Email us, nodunks@theathletic.com. Tweet at us at nodunksinc. Were you a fan of those two? Were they your favorites? Didn't like something about them? Let's hear from you guys. We're staring down the barrel of another great week of No Dunks podcasts. Later today, we're going to hit you with a brand new NBA news roundup. We're going to really focus on Commissioner Silver's Friday phone call with the Players Association and where we currently stand with the possibility of restarting up the season. We got some plans to hit you with a new squad episode. We're starting to work on that. We had some great ideas sent in from you guys out there. So one in particular we really liked, starting to formulate that. So hopefully we'll get going on that one. Wednesday, we're hitting the beach to answer your questions and comments. Thursday, we head to our final No Buffs Tribal Council to recap the last episode of Survivor Winners at War.
You think our episode's going to be 3 hours that day?
how long will it be? Yeah, we got the 3-hour finale on Wednesday night, and then no buffs. Yeah, Tass, I don't know. What do we set it at? Will it be... will we hit 2 hours? Nah, I don't think so.
Let's do a 10-part series on the final episode.
The last tribal council. And on Friday, we're going to have a brand new film session. That's the plan, at least right now. Still figuring out what basketball movie to watch and discuss. So if you have suggestions, I know we tweeted out asking for some suggestions. We got a lot of them. Let us know at No Dunks Inc. Is there a movie out there? JD, do you have a particular basketball movie you would like to tackle?
I am very curious about the Steven Soderbergh. What is it? It's a
High
shot on
bird.
That's it. It's shot on iPhones, and yeah, I'm into that. But you know, I mean, whatever. Oh, that or High School Musical.
Oh yes.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, we gotta make your decision. There's no shortage of basketball movies for us to tackle. So. We'll pick one in the coming days and let you know so you guys can watch it with us in the lead up to film session. All right, Clipper Bros.
You heard it here first. Have a great time. Turn up. Love you guys. Awesome.
Thanks for joining us. And remember, in the words of Will Perdue, let's not get it wrong. He was an asshole. He was a jerk. He crossed the line numerous times. But as time goes on and you think back about what he was actually trying to accomplish, you're like, yeah, he was a hell of a teammate.
Embrace the day, people.
You could stay.